we're talking about bulk influence of human beings, because these giant new digital superstates operate at scale. So the end result means that humanity will not be able to detect what is happening to humanity, because the lies, if you like, or the influence attempts are so fast and so sophisticated. So that then leaves us into a position where humanity can't see what is happening to it. And if it can't see what is happening to it, then it can't possibly change what is happening to it. It's a kind of fake news apocalypse.
That's Julian Assange, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Julian Assange on propaganda, facts, and fake news, part one of a special two-part program. We live in an era of fake news. Fabricated reports go viral on social media. Totally false stories are concocted, then tweeted and retweeted. Fantastical theories and wild claims are circulated in cyberspace. It's as Orwell says in 1984, the lie became truth. There's a lot of fire and fury inflaming the news cycle. The term fake news is an all-purpose smear used by the president and his supporters to deride and dismiss reporting that they don't like. A recent study found that Facebook was by far the platform through which people used to get to a fake news site. The report also noted that older, less educated people were particularly susceptible to fake news. Are facts up for grabs? How are we to navigate the mine-laden waters of propaganda and fake news? Our guest today is Julian Assange. Julian Assange is a journalist, activist, and computer programmer, and is founder of WikiLeaks, the whistleblowing website. WikiLeaks collects and shares confidential information on an international scale. Julian Assange sought asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in London in 2012 to escape allegations of sexual assault. Those charges have since been dropped. Nevertheless, he believes that if he leaves the embassy, he will be nabbed by the United States and prosecuted for publishing thousands of classified documents made available by Chelsea Manning. In 2016, Assange's work again drew enormous attention when WikiLeaks published thousands of emails from U.S. presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and the Democratic National Committee. He spoke in Bergen, Norway. And now, Julian Assange.
I have, of course, seen the debate about fake news. And when this term came up, perhaps a year ago, popularized initially by the US mainstream media, I thought to myself, you know what, this term, fake news, is going to turn around 180 degrees within a few hours and be used to criticize the oligarch-controlled press in the United States and elsewhere. And that's exactly what happened. So I was, in fact, rather pleased with this term. I don't want to suggest that there isn't some newness to the phenomenon. That's not correct. There are some new things occurring, in particular where we're moving into in relation to AI really is a potential change that human beings can have great difficulty encompassing. Essentially, if we're in a competition, as human beings have been for many years, between liars and people who detect lies, artificial intelligence means that the lies can be automated and pumped out en masse. That's not something that is happening yet to a degree where I think we need to seriously worry about it, but it will. Okay, now let's put some things into perspective. Thomas Jefferson in 1807, this is a couple of years after he had had the U.S. presidency, keeping in mind that the U.S. presidency back then was a much smaller affair. There was no standing army of tens or hundreds of thousands of people, and the presidential role was much more of a figurehead role. But Jefferson, who's perhaps the smartest of the founding fathers of the United States, put it like this: nothing can now be believed which is seen in a newspaper. Truth itself becomes suspicious by being put into that polluted vehicle. That's his view from that time. And he goes on to jokingly assert that, well, perhaps a new newspaper should be launched with different sections, the first section being truths and the last section being absolute falsehoods, and in the middle, various types of claims. And the first section would be almost non-existent, and the last section quite large, and the middle padding out the rest. So it's been that way for a very, very long time. And while most people can perceive that the media is not trustworthy, and if you look at that on various opinion polls, you will see that that is quite a common perception amongst people, that the media is not trustworthy. There is a narrative that it is. And, well, why is that? Because I think the media is, in general terms, one of the most destructive forces that has ever existed. It has led to nearly every war that we've had, certainly the wars by democracies, all the big wars that you can name, at least in the post-World War II period, and to a degree, even in World War II, were built up. Their populations were mobilized on the back of lies, from the Gulf of Tonkin incident to the Iraq War to the Gulf War. So the average death count per journalist, I did a calculation for US journalists recently, is something like 130 kills per journalist as a result of them not treating their supposed or claimed societal function seriously, which is to provide the truth, and instead spreading propaganda and lies of the major power establishments in the countries that they're in. First of all, ground this debate about fake news with the reality that the news has always been fake. It has always been something that has been used to manipulate human populations en masse into absolutely disastrous outcomes in order for proprietors of news organizations to, yes, make profits by peddling salacious stories, but much more significantly, to keep their integration with existing establishments in those countries and at a social level for each journalist and editor to ingratiate themselves socially with the very establishments they are meant to be policing. The renewed talk about fake news, well, it's been taken up by Donald Trump in his critiques of CNN, for example. Okay, now, is it true that those responses by Donald Trump are motivated by a president in power trying to distract from critique of the press? Absolutely. Of course, that's the motivation. But is he nonetheless, in general terms, correct? Yes, in general terms, he is correct. CNN, I don't mean to pick on it unnecessarily. It's certainly not the only one. All the big establishment media in the United States, Fox News, CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, are filled every day with very serious and misleading fake news. Why is the term being popularized other than politicians and other people who are criticized in the media using it to rebuff that criticism, whether that criticism is true or, as it very often is, false? Well, the US election saw an outbreak of uncontrolled popularism. Now, that popularism was harnessed by what is effectively neo-fascistic cultural sentiments. That's true. It was harnessed in various ways by those groups. But nonetheless, it is a democratic outburst that occurred principally because of the increased ease with which human beings can share information with each other, social media, small publishers, etc. And that, of course, has led to cultural change. It's led to cultural change, not simply because of underpinning reasons, which many people on the left talk about, such as the decline in US real wages from 1978, or by the concerns that people on the right talk about, for example, increased immigration, but rather because the establishment press is integrated with the existing order of things and is used to has been used to create that order and to maintain it. Whether you see a decrease in the existing order as a positive or a negative depends on where you think that is going, and whether you stand to lose or gain in the process of that change. Do we accept that the press has a serious influence on society and the ideas that are passed around? Some ideas are pushed more than others, other ideas are suppressed, other ideas are introduced through the press. We all know that the press has been used to mobilize nations for illegal wars, for example. Okay, I say that in democracy, especially, the press is one of the principal controlling functions of the existing establishment, the existing order of things. So when that control structure can be worked around, social media, new publishers starting up with very little capital because of the internet, is that going to change the existing order of things? Obviously, if your claim was that the press is intimately part of the existing order of things, and there's a new press which is not part of the existing order of things, then obviously the order, the cultural order, and to some degree the relative balance of who has power and who does not is going to change. So this has terribly frightened existing establishments, and those existing establishments are, of course, integrated with the establishment press by definition. So why we see such talk in the establishment press about the fear of fake news is not simply because it's another thing to be salacious about, not simply because there is to some degree a new phenomenon. So the existing establishments, including of course the press, which is integrated with them, see this uncontrolled phenomenon as a direct threat. To their power and also to the existing order, which creates fear in themselves and also directly for the press itself. So the press talks about it a lot and tries to push forwards for there to be greater controls in the spreading of information. And this has then led to a very serious situation, extremely serious situation, where pressure has been applied to Facebook, Google, these giant new digital superstates, these giant intermediaries, to regain control of the informational flow system of the West, broadly speaking, to prevent outbursts of populism and unexpected outcomes, of which are the election of Donald Trump, or rather the failure to elect Hillary Clinton, is the most obvious example. And that was put in concrete terms in France in the Macron election. So feeling the heat of criticism, Facebook and Google decided to explicitly intervene in the French election. That is to say explicitly that they were setting up a mutual task force to prevent the spreading of what they called fake news during the French election. Now, is it true that fake news was spread during the French election? Of course. Fake news is spread in the mainstream press and small press and social media in every election. But the question of who determines what is fake news and what is not, of course, is decided by the forces that come together to make the claim and to make the censorship system involved. And of course, in this case, those forces wanted to see Emmanuel Macron elected and not Marine Le Pen. Now, of course, there are good reasons to be concerned about both of these candidates. But nonetheless, this was an overt intervention by Google and Facebook, American Silicon Valley companies, into the French election with the construction of a censorship system, which they said was there in order to stop what they assessed to be or claimed to be fake news. Okay. Perhaps we'll go on to a question. I can, of course, talk. I'd like to talk as we go ahead about where this is going in terms of artificial intelligence, and of course, I can talk in practical terms about the roles of various spy agencies and so on. But as I said, the attempts to influence the public have always been there for a very, very long time. There are some new elements, but I don't think that they're significant. What I do think is very significant is the debate by existing establishment press to say that certain forms of information spread need to be stopped. And that is then leading to a new norm of automated censorship by giant Silicon Valley companies of the information that we communicate with each other. That's very serious.
Thank you very much, Julian. Now, we move on to the next point on our programme, namely the interview with Julian Assange. Those of you in the audience who want to address Assange should line up here in front of the podium during the interview. I call on the Holberg Prize communications officer, Ulla Sandmo, to conduct the interview. And Ulla, I yield the floor to you.
Thank you, Alan. And Julian, thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to cover a few topics over the next 15 or so minutes, starting with perhaps the most important and deadly aspect of propaganda, that is, its application in issues of war and peace. Using the Syrian case as an example, journalist Patrick Cockburn wrote earlier this year that fabricated news and one-sided reporting have taken over the news agenda to a degree probably not seen since the First World War. Do you agree, and do you currently see any winners in the global propaganda war?
Thank you. I mean, on the Syrian case, it's very clear that all sides have engaged in serious propaganda in that conflict. And of course, you can understand all the direct belligerents grasping every tool that they can in order to preserve themselves or to win. What's, I suppose, noteworthy is that the media power that exists for Bashar al-Assad and his allies in that war, Iran and Russia, is almost for Syria, it's essentially non-existent, for Iran, almost non-existent, and for Russia, pretty insignificant compared to the media power of those states like the United States, the UK, France, etc., which have been belligerents in one way in that war. I do think it is a very interesting question whether the situation has objectively become worse. Clearly, our ability to detect fake news by various establishments of different countries and at a popular level has tremendously increased because we're able to compare the outputs of different countries and we're able to use the internet to collect underlying facts. And WikiLeaks is an example of that as a primary source repository, a pristine primary source repository, which can be used to both make and also check various claims. I think in a way, it has become worse. And that is the speed of information spread is so fast that false claims, salacious false claims, can spread around the world very, very quickly. Now, of course, they were always spread around the world, but with a slightly lower cost, higher cost to making false claims. Why do I say that? Well, the debate over whether a claim is false or not is rapidly displaced by new information, which is spreading everywhere. So there's a kind of churn or chaos in the spread of information, which means that debate or accusations about whether a newspaper produced fabricated coverage is swept aside. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that those debates ever really happened properly. You look at the fabricated front page stories of the New York Times, which were then spread, we must remember, not just by the New York Times, but nearly every single European, Australian, Canadian, etc. paper on their front page, under the basis that they can always just pass the buck to the New York Times. They were never held accountable for producing those fabricated front pages.
All right. I'll move on to a different topic. I'll try and cover a few if we have time. Now, since we're talking about competing narratives, I have to ask you about the allegation that WikiLeaks conspired with the Russian government and the Trump campaign to hack the U.S. election and publish emails from the Democratic National Committee and from Clinton's campaign manager, John Podesta. Now, you have consistently denied these allegations, but they're still presented as fact by much of the established media. What's your take on this?
It's a very interesting form of fake news. On the one hand, we have WikiLeaks. We don't speak about our sources in general, but we have said our source is not a state in this case. Okay. So that's that's our claim. There's been no presentation of evidence that claim is not a correct claim. What are the allegations, the formal allegations by US intelligence agencies? They obviously can't be trusted. Their business, CIA's business, is both stealing information and fabricating information. That's its business. Its statements obviously can't be trusted. But what are its statements at their strongest? Its statements at their strongest is that there were hacks of the DNC. They provide no evidence. It's their assessment. There are hacks of the DNC that they believe was in somehow sponsored by Russia. And this information then flowed through some third parties and came to us. And we published it. That's the US intelligence allegation at its strongest. They say explicitly that there's not an allegation that WikiLeaks conspired with Russia or conspired with the Trump campaign. That's not the allegation from the US intelligence services. But are there allegations that WikiLeaks did conspire with US intelligence services and the Trump campaign? Yes, every day. Those are made every day in the US press, fabricating even the strongest allegation of the US intelligence services. So here we have an interesting example where the statements of the CIA are more moderate than the statements of the US mainstream press. It's very interesting that you would think that the CIA would be making outlandish allegations, and then the press would be checking those allegations and somehow producing a less strident form of them. It's exactly the opposite.
All right. Now, I know WikiLeaks protects his sources. I have to ask you, you have denied that your source for the email leak was Russia or other state actors, but you have also gone further. And in an interview with Dutch TV, you raised the issue of murdered Democratic staffer Seth Rich and related it to how your sources take huge risks. Twice thereafter, WikiLeaks offered a reward for information on Rich's murder. Aren't you contributing to outrageous conspiracy theories and fake news by doing this?
My concern is that at that time, that a young Democratic staffer had been murdered in Washington, D.C., shot in the back under suspicious circumstances. And there's allegations that are serious that Rich was in some way connected to the sourcing of WikiLeaks material. Obviously, we're never going to confirm that or deny it. But such an allegation about someone who's alleged to be one of our sources has to be very seriously checked. And it hasn't been very seriously checked by the media. In fact, there's a presentation that that's a conspiracy theory. Is it true that there are statements by Republicans that go well beyond what the publicly available evidence is in that case? That's absolutely true. It's been instrumentalized for political purposes. But is it also true that that's a serious case of someone being murdered in Washington, D.C., and needs to be investigated, as do the allegations that they had anything to do with WikiLeaks sourcing?
Now, WikiLeaks sources are encouraged to use an anonymous Dropbox. If Russia had been your source, would it matter as long as the leaked information could be verified?
It wouldn't matter to us. There's an always important question when you see a story appear in the press. What are the motivations behind that story appearing, both at the press level and whatever the sourcing is? But that's a separate story. It's okay for people to investigate that. In fact, in some ways, I wish those types of things were investigated more. But it's not okay to use it as a distraction from the content of the material. Obviously, in most cases, the material that is published, the leaked material, must take precedence, and provided it is true information, the public can rely on it. But machinations that occur to produce things in newspapers, yeah, they should be scrutinized, as should the nature of publishing organizations, who owns them, who controls them, etc.
You're listening to Julian Assange on Propaganda, Facts, and Fake News, part one of a special two-part program.
Now, you recently confirmed that WikiLeaks was approached by the firm Cambridge Analytica in the run-up to the U.S. election last year. But you also stated that you told them, in your own words, to bugger off. Now, could you comment on what it was that Cambridge Analytica wanted from you, and more generally explain what it is that they do that has created such media interest?
Well, this came out because of a leaked email from that time period of Cambridge Analytica. This is not my claim. A leaked email appearing in, I think it was the Daily Beast originally, which has Chelsea Clinton on its board. It's a hostile paper in that sense, published an email showing that Cambridge Analytica had attempted to approach us, wondering what we were going to publish and could they get early access to it. And we had said no.
But I'm interested in if you could explore a little bit what it is that Cambridge Analytica does that seems to have...
I see. Yeah. Right. I mean, it's quite interesting. I mean, you look at that Cambridge Analytica story. When we first saw this story, we thought, this is great. This is independent documentary proof that we had nothing to do with sharing our publications or anything like that with the Trump campaign. Independent proof, an approach by Cambridge Analytica and a rejection by us. But of course, the rejection part in maybe 5-6 of the US press is suppressed because it doesn't fit a certain movement, which is there for various reasons, but ultimately different forces coming together in an attempt to install Mike Pence as president. Okay, Cambridge Analytica, it's a UK firm. It's been going for about 20 years. It's a type of marketing firm, and it claimed some magic to produce psychological profiles. And according to its statements, it does about one-third of its work around the world in helping particular election team's study, which ads are best at influencing which voters based upon their personality profiles, etc. But that's only one third of its work. The other third is being hired by the military and intelligence services to, it claims, to create influence in, for example, Afghanistan, to influence people in that way. And the last third, commercial influence, which I assume has to do with influencing people to support a company or to perhaps buy some product. I'm rather unconvinced that they have something special. Why is that? The commercial market for influencing people is very, very competitive and aggressive. So product advertisers, the big marketing firms, are in a ferocious competition, which is coupled together with the data collection power of organizations like Facebook and Google. So when you see a company engaged in government contracts and contracts with political parties who don't like to talk about who their advertising partners are, that's a less competitive environment. It's not a good market. And when you have an opaque market, you can't see who is proficient and who is not so proficient. So in general, when you see a company that has lots of government contracts, you understand that a lot of its resources are going into developing contacts within various governments rather than in refining the most proficient style of product.
Right. This seems to be very essential to the topic of manipulation of information. You touched on the topic of artificial intelligence. With reference to Facebook's and Twitter's involvement in the last presidential election in France, you said earlier this year, quote, imagine a Daily Mail run by essentially artificial intelligence. What does that look like when there's only the Daily Mail worldwide? That's what Facebook and Twitter will shift into, end quote. So could you explore that a little bit more? How big is this threat and what can be done about the risks associated with artificial intelligence in terms of manipulation of information and propaganda?
It's overwhelmingly the biggest threat to humanity. It's a much bigger threat than climate change. Artificial intelligence means... Look, I've met some very savvy pathological liars, psychopaths. Very, very clever and hard to discern. Now, I'm sure all of you have met one or two of those types of people. Just imagine their capacity to lie and deceive multiplied by 1,000. It's not something that human beings can detect when it is at a certain level of proficiency. So human beings for the last 15, 20 years, we have been documenting ourselves with billions of hours of video uploaded to YouTube with all the thoughts and expressions that we have put on web pages and photo sharing, all the things that we have been searching for, the photos taken by Google Maps as it drives around streets, our current locations, which is communicated by smartphones, etc. An extremely rich, multivariable description of most of humanity, or at least that part which has any influence on the world. Very, very rich description. That is being used to train artificial intelligence systems. In fact, Silicon Valley, those people who are interested in this type of thing, we've kind of had a model of how it works, what form of capitalism it is. It's surveillance capitalism. Its business is to create so-called free services, bait, if you like your Google search engine, or the free software that Google puts onto Android phones, which power 80% of the smartphones worldwide, and use that bait to collect information from people, what you search for example, and then harvest enormous in some informational resource. In some models, it's a kind of resource extraction that comes in and scrapes off information from Norway, like in other countries, like a giant open-cut mine, and collects it in Silicon Valley, and then creates profiles and sells them to advertisers. Yeah, so it's the informational middleman. That's all changing. That model is completely changing. As a result of surveillance capitalism, as a result of harnessing all that information from the world, it's enough to then create and to train artificial intelligences. That's how, for example, Google Translate has been able to come up with 65 language pairs now, and it's getting quite good. It's kind of as good as an average human translator in many cases, and one that can work 24 hours a day, etc. So instead of thinking about Google Translate, think about Google Liar. Instead of simply translating information, it's actually translating this giant repository of how human beings behave into information that can be projected to human beings to cause them to act in particular ways. Google Liar. Already that's happening in a more primitive form, which is to adjust the search rankings, for example. As a result of the establishment fears in the United States from this unruly outburst of populism that led to Hillary Clinton not being elected, Google decided to invisibly re-rank nearly all the establishment critical press. So both on the right and on the left, from the World Socialist website, which went down by 60%, to WikiLeaks, which was pushed down by 30%, The Intercept pushed down 19%, Counterpunch pushed down about 40%. So that has had invisible effect on the behavior of human beings, just based on what they're searching for. Similarly, if you go to YouTube and you see some video that's recommended or not, nearly all foreign policy critiques that are uploaded to YouTube have been demonetized as a form of economic censorship. Those producers who were producing content that was critical of US foreign policy, they don't get any money anymore. No money from Google. This is much more insidious than the case of someone producing a finely crafted news story that is fake, such as that WikiLeaks documents are fabricated. That was the number one fake news story in the United States, according to a study by Stanford. That fake news story was produced not by some site in Macedonia. That fake news story was produced by Newsweek, and who were subsequently sued, and they retracted the article. So instead of finely crafted false messaging like that, think at a strategic level. We're talking about bulk influence of human beings, because these giant new digital superstates operate at scale. So you can have bulk influence. But unlike previous efforts at bulk influence, for example, BBC or a national broadcaster coming up with a line and trying to culturally influence the entire population or politically influence the entire population, we're talking about bulk influence through mass individual targeting of individual psychology, which has been collected by these giant new AI organizations. So that the end result means that humanity will not be able to detect what is happening to humanity, because the lies, if you like, or the influence attempts are so fast and so sophisticated. So that then leaves us into a position where humanity can't see what is happening to it. And if it can't see what is happening to it, then it can't possibly change what is happening to it. It's a kind of a fake news apocalypse, if you think about it. Before that point, all we can discuss what is occurring, as we're doing now. We can discuss it, we can change it to a degree. At some point, people cannot perceive what is occurring because it is too sophisticated and too fast. And at that point, we have no ability to discuss it. It's kind of like a fake information cloud that can cover the actions of these digital superstates and their allies. China has them as well. It's really only China and the United States. It's similar to what occurred during the Cold War, where literal fake clouds would be placed over missile sites. Yeah. Literal fake clouds, so that satellite photography would not be able to observe what was going on. Here we have a information fake cloud that can cover the actions of what is becoming the major power groups internationally.
The way I see it, WikiLeaks pioneered this movement for true journalism and inspired many of us. And my question is, because I see, for instance, International Consortium of Investigative Journalists coming up with a mega trillion data that are very important to societies. So I think, do you think there is a movement also like a resistance from society building up these movements from people who see that they are lying and manipulating us? Thank you.
It's a very interesting question. There definitely has been, and the successes of WikiLeaks have gone on to inspire other organizations to adopt some parts of its models. In the ICIJ case, it's a bit mixed. They've done some very good work in terms of organizing lots of journalists together. Unfortunately, they don't publish. So while there are claims about giant leaks, actually the public doesn't have these. Yeah, the public has perhaps a few hundred documents only have been published. Otherwise, it's a consortium that has them. The benefits are it's a bit bigger consortium than normal. It's not just two or three big news outlets, but it's maybe 100 news outlets. But it is run from Washington, D.C., and they select their news outlets. So it's a little mixed, but compared to what was the status before, it is very positive. On the reaction side, because it's so relatively cheap now to create a website and start a little publisher, there has been a reaction for the last 10 years, really. Perhaps the last 3 years in particular. But there's been an enormous back reaction. So quite substantial forces in existing establishments are concerned about their increasing lack of control. And they're projecting that concern. Some of the concern is perhaps real. It is a change in the order of things that has downsides. But it is certainly a moment for change to be grabbed. It's not simply what's happening with the internet. That's probably the leading cause, but something else is happening, which is that the United States and its international influence architecture is in a post-primacy period. It's very simple to explain. It's gone from about 50% of global GDP post-World War II to about 25%, and the rest of the world is developing. Europe is basically static. China has the largest GDP by purchasing power parity, which is the interesting metric. Europe is just below that, and the United States is again below that. So the West still has a substantial majority of GDP in those big blocks. But we're definitely moving away from this unipolar world now for some years. And the empire is not able to hold on to all that it could hold on to in the post-Cold War period. It's starting to not have the capacity to hold on to all that it did hold on to. So as a result, there's a change in order. And that change in order feels like chaos to certain people. That's basically happening.
I'm just wondering, you mentioned the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Since we are now living in the wake of consequences of 9/11, do you feel now that we need a new investigation of 9/11?
It's an interesting question. The original investigation of 9/11 was, of course, you can see from which documents were restricted, compromised by the United States' diplomatic power sensitivities concerning the role of Saudi Arabia, perhaps to a degree, the role of a couple of other states. But obviously all these things should be investigated. It's quite interesting to see, after 50 years, new JFK documents coming out. There's not so much interest there directly concerning the murder, but the geopolitical environment, the attempts by the United States to assassinate other people, for example, is quite revealing. On the 9/11 issue generally, I don't think it is particularly important in the sense that every day or every few weeks, WikiLeaks and some other publishers publish proof of very serious existing conspiracies that are happening right now or just a couple of years ago in order to start wars or steal billions of dollars. These things, I think, can have more of a change. There's a certain view in relation to 9/11 that it's some kind of holy grail that would shake the existing order of things. I don't think it would, even if it came out that there were some rogue agents involved. And that's how it would be positioned, no matter who it was.
I want to address who is in power of defining the truth, or actually redefining it. I just wonder if you have experienced important laws and so on suddenly became unimportant, and maybe minor laws you have been facing, and then you are facing maybe criminal charges for something smaller, and you know they redefine, and this is difficult. It's very difficult to go through all the laws and everything.
Yeah, I mean that is the nature of power. It defines itself through its own exceptionality, i.e., its own ability to not follow the laws that it says everyone else must follow, or to allege that people are involved in offences where they are not. That's happened to me personally in many, many different ways. It's just come out here in the UK, for example, that there was a conspiracy between the UK and Sweden. I was never charged in that case, and I've won it. It's come out that there was a conspiracy, secret files being kept in Sweden that were untraceable. That's how they're described by the Swedish officials. We are keeping a secret file that is untraceable, that only one Swedish official, another Swedish official know about, and the UKN, and then to destroy and hide documents and so on. You can also see it in the behaviour of many, many states. In my own case, the behaviour of the UK in not recognising the decision of the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, which in 2006 ruled that I'm being illegally detained. We went to competitive litigation. I took the UK and Sweden to the highest body in the world to assess whether someone is being unlawfully held or not. And we submitted our arguments, the UK responded, and it lost. It appealed, re-recognising the jurisdiction, and it lost again, and it then ignored the judgment and refused to implement it. So, sure, it happens all the time. It is the nature of power. The killing of Socrates, well, that was legal. Jesus, that was legal. The Holocaust within the realm of the Third Reich, that was legal. Hanging of blacks, slavery, all legal. So that's the nature of the law. I think the way I look at it is, of course, the law is unjust. No state can avoid the corruption that is involved of administrating law to itself. That can't be avoided. But insofar as we can make laws predictable, even though they are unjust, we have an opportunity to structure our lives to avoid the injustice. For example, a cliff is very unjust. You never did anything to it. You're just walking along, and bang, you fall over the cliff and die. A cliff is extremely unjust. It's very unfair, but you know exactly where it is, and so you avoid it. It's the arbitrariness in the abuse of law, not simply the unfairness. This arbitrariness which can strike at people like lightning.
Do you think that WikiLeaks could be used as a propaganda tool for groups with strong intelligence that are still spreading truth, but that could be skewed to a certain sector? Thank you.
Powerful groups, by definition, are connected to establishment press, and that is the best place in the world to get out propaganda because they don't publish full documents, and therefore they can't be assessed by everyone forensically and argued about whether they're true or not. WikiLeaks has a very enviable record of accuracy. So a perfect record of accuracy of authenticating what we publish is what we say we publish. There's no publisher in the world that publishes any substantial volume that has a record as good as that. Now, to be fair, our job is a little easier. It's much clearer. It's either an authentic official document or it's not. It's pretty much a black and white, whether it's been modified or it is pristine.
Do liberal democracies have the necessary tools to deal with fake news?
Liberal democracies almost by definition are fake news. As a result of them being both liberal in the real sense that those of us, not me, but those of us who are in so-called liberal democracies do benefit from certain types of freedom, and being democracies. People being free to do things and there being a democracy means that what is in people's heads is extremely important. The existing order cannot survive without controlling what is in people's heads. So the sophisticated fake news system evolves in democracies. In some ways, it's interesting to think about which comes first, which is the horse and which is the cart. If you have a relatively free press, is it the case that you end up with a more democratic forms and then in response to that, an increasing demand to control the press in various ways? Or if you have a relatively democratic intrinsics, such as a widely dispersed population, not too clustered in one point, do you then end up with a kind of democratic phenomenon which then can permit certain forms of press to exist?
You said in the beginning that fake news has been used by all different sides and that's basically been turned around 180 degrees and that it's become a catch-all term. And I was wondering if you feel like there's any hope for reconciliation between all of the different sides and if we could ever get to an era that's kind of post-fake news and if we should want to get to an era that's post-fake news. So what should be done to get less fake news and should we want to get less fake news?
It's difficult. The truth is expensive to create. Look at WikiLeaks. It's quite hard. I used to have a very different view. For example, institutions, as a byproduct of their own institutional process, their own logistical process, produce mountains of true information, how they order things, the decisions that they're made. Of course, there's certain internal psychological plays, but from the outside, a mountain of information is every institution is sustained by it. And so the amount of fake information that every institution can produce is relatively small compared to that mountain of true information that it has to have to simply sustain its operations. And so that WikiLeaks can stick its straw, if you like, on behalf of the rest of the world into these repositories of information that every institution has, true information, take it out and present it to the world. But the automation of distorted information and its automated distribution is actually something that is quite hard to compete with, because once you start automating the production of false information, the marginal cost per additional piece of information produced starts to approach zero. So the clash of the different camps claiming fake news, well, I mean, they're all right. It's essentially all right. The various media are producing fake news that benefits them. The result is, I think, it pushes various groups to increasing bifurcation, so increasing separation between different groups, because there's a claim about the other, and these claims become more false and are used to create greater unity within a particular group, especially in response to disorder. That's part of what is happening now, that the increasing false claims, where they're coming from existing establishment-aligned press outfits or individuals about fears of the other particular countries, Russia, for example, but also within Russia about other countries. These, I believe, are motivated to try and pull together the existing order in the face of the destabilization which is occurring from other factors. So I don't see them coming together. Thank you.
That was Julian Assange on propaganda, facts, and fake news, part one of a special two-part program. He spoke in Bergen, Norway. Julian Assange is the founder of WikiLeaks, the whistleblowing website. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Glenn Greenwald, Alfred McCoy, Michael Parenti, Angela Davis, Noam Chomsky, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Naomi Klein. And by the way, my new book with Noam Chomsky, Global Discontents, The Rising Threats to Democracy, is just out. You can order it from us. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Ole Andreas Sanmo. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.